WVXU's first home was on Xavier's campus. Then, 20 years ago, it became part of Cincinnati Public Radio and moved to rented space on Central Parkway. Now, your NPR station is moving to a new home for our local public radio stations in Evanston. Follow our progress at cinradio.org/move.
Ohio's boards of elections are being bombarded with challenges to voter registrations. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our Friday News Review, we'll discuss where these challenges are coming from and how elections officials are handling them. Then, we have new information on that styrene leak in Whitewater Township. The rail company allegedly let hazardous materials sit for days on the tracks. And what's going on with Frisch's? Restaurants are closing and more could be closed soon. Here to kick off the news review is Ohio Public Media Statehouse News Bureau reporter and producer Joe Ingles. Welcome back, Joe.
Great to be with you.
Oh, it's great to have you. We're going to get to election coverage in just a moment. But first, a Hamilton County judge ruled Thursday on Ohio's 6-week abortion ban. Tell us about the ruling.
Well, you might remember that this was the case that kept getting delayed and delayed and delayed again. It involved the what is called the so-called heartbeat bill that basically said that you couldn't get an abortion once any kind of fetal activity was detected. And that's about 6 weeks. So some people call it a 6-week ban because that's when it's mostly effective. And that ban was in effect from the time Roe versus Wade was overturned. That very same day it went into effect, and it stayed into effect until the middle of September in that year. And then it's been on hold ever since in this Hamilton County court, and they've tried to figure out, you know, what they're going to do with it. So then finally, yesterday, the judge came out and said, okay, you cannot have this heartbeat bill. It goes against the new reproductive rights amendment that voters passed in 2023. You cannot have that, but there were some appealable parts of it because they sued over that law. And of course, the law had a lot of things attached to it that were in addition to that 6-week ban. For instance, there were reporting guidelines that were attached to it. There were rules about how doctors could process, you know, when they did an abortion, what the rules were for that. There was even a little bit on adoption. So there was like little things around the edges that, you know, went into that bill. And those things can now be brought to a court and eventually go to the Supreme Court, I guess. And the Supreme Court would be the place that it would stop, the Ohio Supreme Court, that is. And so as far as the 6-week ban, it's gone, I'm told, by several different people. But the other parts of that law could be resurrected in some form or fashion, either an appeal in court or in new legislation.
Okay, so ultimately those other pieces around the edges, those parts of the law could make their way to the Ohio Supreme Court, you think?
They could. If the state decides to appeal this and take it up, they could take it to the Ohio Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court would set the definitions and deal with that. Or lawmakers could come back. We're getting ready for a lame duck session. And they could come back during lame duck and start putting this stuff in other pieces of legislation. We've seen that over and over. And that might be what they want to do, just because that could be a faster way to get it done.
Okay. And I do want to circle back. You mentioned that this controversial bill has been called the heartbeat bill. The American Obstetrics and Gynecology Association says it's clinically inaccurate to use the word heartbeat because of the sound that can be heard in an ultrasound very early in pregnancy, because there are no chambers of the heart developed at that early stage in pregnancy.
Right.
So just want to throw that out there. Let's get to our elections discussions. Tell us about these challenges that the Ohio's boards of elections are getting. Boards of elections all over the state are getting challenges.
It's been wild out there right now because the boards of elections are getting challenges from ordinary people. Now, what a challenge is basically is if I think that maybe my neighbor or someone is registered to vote, but they're not they shouldn't be registered to vote, or there's something wrong with it, I can go online, because anyone can go online, and we can find out, you know, who's registered, how they're registered. And if that doesn't jive with what you think is the real situation, you can file a challenge. And when you file a challenge, what that does is that means that the Board of Elections has to go in and they have to actually look at the challenge and interview the party involved, which takes time. And then after they interview them, then they have to make a decision, look at the information, make a decision. And, you know, the thing is, Lucy, that some of these boards of elections are just overwhelmed. For example, the Wood County Board of Elections up in the Toledo area, they say that they've had 16,000 voter registrations challenged. That's about 19% of their total voter registration in the county. Okay.
Wow.
Yeah, that's a lot. And you figure these boards of elections, they're not sitting over there eating bonbons right now, because they've got a lot to be doing to prepare for this election that's coming up. And they've got a lot of things that and they've got early voting going on, right? So there's a whole lot going on at these boards of elections already. Their plate is already full, and now they've got challenges on top of it coming in that they have to process. So it has been challenging, I should say, for the boards of elections.
Yeah. And is it illegal to be registered to vote in more than one state? I understand that's sometimes things that these average citizens, they're seeing maybe some finding out somebody's registered in more than one state, and they're calling that into question.
They call it into question. That's like a flag that people look at. They're registered in more than one state, so they must be committing voter fraud. But that's not what it is. They can be registered in more than one state. They can only vote in one state. So, for example, if I had a voter registration in Ohio and a voter registration in, let's pick a state, Florida. If I had voter registrations in both places and I voted in both places, that's voter fraud. But a lot of people who have those kind of registrations in different places, they are a voter in one place at one time, and then, you know, their situation changes and they vote in another place, and that one, the old one, stays on the rolls. So it's not like that's a flag for, you know, people wanting to check out those voter registrations, but it's not in any way saying that someone's guilty of voting fraud.
Where are these challenges typically coming from? Are there kind of organized groups making these challenges?
Well, there have been. There's been, especially, you know, with the people who question the integrity of the votes right now, the people who are questioning whether the ballots are being handled properly and whether there are illegal voters coming in. You hear all these claims from people that there's all these illegal voters. And so, you know, you've got to challenge them. That's where this is coming from. And there was a conservative podcaster that has been banging this drum. And a lot of people have been listening to them thinking, hey, it's my civic duty to go through the voter rolls and find if, you know, someone might be guilty of voter fraud. But as we know, voter fraud is very, very rare.
What do these elections officials typically find when they look into these challenges?
Well, usually nothing. But the thing is that here's the problem. You look into the challenge and it takes time because, you know, you've got to get the person who's registered in two places, whatever the challenge is, you've got to get the person involved to come in and do an interview, or, you know, sometimes they can do it a different way, but you still got to do an interview with that person. And when you're talking thousands of people, that's a lot. And you're pushing paper involved with all these things. It's a time-consuming venture.
Yeah. Have boards of elections gotten challenges in these quantities before? You were talking about that county that had thousands and thousands. I mean, almost one in five of their registrations have been challenged. Is this new to have them in this kind of quantity?
No, they're saying they've never had them in these quantities. They're saying, you know, before they might have had, you know, a few, but nothing like this. Before it was, you know, someone kind of questioned, you know, someone that they knew, or, you know, they weren't going through voter rolls like this looking for, you know, things to challenge.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about another voting issue. Some organizations in Ohio have expressed concerns that naturalized citizens are being denied the opportunity to vote. Who's speaking out about this, and what kind of concerns are they raising?
Well, a lot of voting rights groups are speaking out about this. And in fact, the ACLU of Ohio has actually filed a suit over this. And what they're saying is there are people who are going to the polls to vote. They are citizens, but they have an ID, a voter ID, either a driver's license or something else that has non-citizen on the back of it. And the reason is that, you know, they can come in and, you know, they get an ID or a driver's license, whatever, and they are not a citizen at that point, but then they earn their citizenship and they don't run out and get a new ID. Now, federal law back in 2006, 2008, somewhere around there, there was a law that basically said, a federal court ruling actually, that said that requiring someone to show citizenship by producing citizenship papers at polling booths, that's illegal. But what Secretary of State LaRose has been doing is saying, you know, if someone has non-citizen on the back of their ID, then that will be enough that the voter should be questioned and put through a provisional ballot if they don't have an acceptable way to prove that they are indeed a citizen.
Hmm. So what do these groups want Ohio Secretary of State Frank LaRose to do about this?
Well, they want him to stop it. They're saying that, you know, people who have this designation, this is not supposed to be by law. It is not supposed to be a way to try to catch people who are, you know, disenfranchised is the word they use, voters who are naturalized citizens. They're saying that this is being used as a way to disproportionately go after people who are naturalized citizens, and they want it stopped, at least for this election. And they're saying that even the state law doesn't really say that that's the way it should be handled.
Well, and my understanding is, so the Secretary of State has some of this kind of spelled out on his website to direct other boards of elections officials. Do they want him to change that? Is that part of it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. They want him to take that down. They want him to revise his directive. And he already, there already was some revision to the directive before, like a month ago, but they want him to go in and basically take that out of there. And, you know, they're saying, well, you know, there's just not any proof that there's any voter fraud from this. And all it's doing is making it difficult for naturalized citizens to vote. So they're wanting that removed. But so far, Secretary of State LaRose has not taken it. He's actually going to a step further, and he's going to he's filed a suit against Homeland Security. And basically, it's saying that he wants them to allow him to get in there and be able to get citizenship information for these voters.
Oh, so that he can verify any, or that
he can verify.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. That has not been allowed yet.
Yeah. Has the Secretary of State responded in any other kinds of ways to this, to the challenges that these voter rights groups have made?
Well, the Secretary of State has said that, you know, the way that they've been doing it, you know, people can vote. He's not denying them the opportunity to vote. He's just saying they need to vote a provisional ballot, and then they can come back with proof that they are a citizen. But that requires another step. And, you know, someone might not be able to come back and prove that they are a citizen because they might not have the paperwork handy, or, you know, there might be some other reason. And that's why these groups are saying, well, that's not good enough. Provisional ballot is basically saying you're taking that group out and treating them differently. And it's not a fair way to be treated.
Okay. Well, I've been talking with Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau reporter and producer Joe Ingles. Thank you so much for your time today, Joe.
It's Lucy.
Up next, the rail company behind a styrene leak in Whitewater Township is facing new questions. Why were hazardous chemicals left sitting for days? This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. It's been a month since a styrene leak forced residents in the southwest corner of Hamilton County to evacuate their homes, and those residents still have questions about what happened. Joining me now to discuss how close they are to getting answers is WCPO9 I-Team reporter Dan Monk. Welcome back, Dan.
Thanks for having me, Lucy.
It's always great to have you here. We've talked on our program about last month's styrene leak from a rail car in this southwest corner of Hamilton County, as I mentioned. What's the likely cause of that? What do we know about the cause?
Well, they've blamed it on a stabilizer. When you ship styrene, you ship it with a stabilizing chemical that keeps it from polymerizing, which means hardening. That's a process that creates heat, and that's where all the pressure came from. And then the train had a valve that triggered when all that heat was building up, and that's why we had the incident.
Okay. You got some information that showed how bad that incident could have been. Tell us about that.
Well, the county's emergency management agency asked a federal agency for an immediate sort of feedback on what could happen in a worst-case scenario here. And it was kind of scary. I mean, they talked about 227 deaths that would have been possible had the thing exploded, and another 281 possible injuries. So it was pretty serious situation.
Yeah, that is scary. Residents in that area still have questions about what happened. Mm-hmm. Cleves Councilman Gary Walters told you he believes Central Railroad of Indiana let the hazardous materials sit too long. Got a little audio about that.
It was there for 7 to 8 days. And the fact of the matter is that while the federal regulations allows for certain criteria for them to go ahead and store it, I would have said to INEOS, this is your product. If you can handle it, we don't want to be responsible for it.
What? I mean, that's pretty clear. I mean, what kind of response is he getting, or is he getting much response about this?
Well, I mean, the railroad says that the Federal Railroad Administration has looked at this and had no objection to their handling of this material. But I also talked to a railroad inspector, a retired railroad inspector, who knew the rules pretty well. And he pointed to this thing called the 48-hour rule. And basically, it says that rail carriers are supposed to keep hazardous materials moving. You have 48 hours from the time it shows up in your yard to actually put it in motion to ship it. And then you're not supposed to stop any material that's flammable or toxic, and styrene is both of these. And so you're not supposed to let things sit on the tracks. However, there is an exception for things that are constructively placed, and that basically means you got it to its destination, and for some reason you weren't able to unload it. And that's what happened in this case. The INEOS plant in Addison was apparently not able to accept this cargo for some reason. They haven't explained. And the railroad said, you know, that's basically why it sat there for 7 to 8 days. And they're not bound by this rule because the material is constructively placed.
Mm. And INEOS, tell us a little bit more about that company, what you know about it. It obviously uses styrene to do something.
Yeah, they use styrene to make rubber and plastic products. And they've been there a long time. They've been known by a lot of names, including Monsanto way back in the day.
That one sounds more familiar.
Yeah. And this is a plant that's had some pollution problems over the years, leading to a consent decree several years ago. They haven't had major violations since then, but it is a well-known plant in Hamilton County. And typically, it's one of the larger emitters of hazardous material.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that Central Railroad of Indiana has said, hey, you know, we didn't break that rule because of all these other circumstances. Mm-hmm. Has the railroad offered any other response to these concerns that people like Councilmember Walters are raising?
Well, they've done a lot, actually, to answer citizen questions. There was a public meeting on October 1st, and this issue came up a lot. You know, why was that stuff on the train tracks right across the street from a grocery store, less than a mile from a school? And, you know, their answer was that's not going to happen anymore. So what they said was they've informed INEOS that from now on, if they have a delivery, they will accept the delivery. And if we took some aerial shots of that plant, it's a huge plant, and it has a lot of rail sidings off of the main track where, you know, cars can be stored. I mean, INEOS hasn't said why they didn't accept it on that day, but there's clearly room on that site for additional rail cars. So I don't know if it's because you know, they didn't think they had room for it on the tracks that they had, or if they weren't ready to use it in the manufacturing process, so they just let it park on a side rail that belonged to the railroad. You know, it's not really clear at this point.
Yeah. What does Councilman Walters think about that? Those explanations, at least what he's hearing from the railroad?
I think he doesn't want to hear that, you know, we can store material at any time. I mean, the railroad did tell me that that rule not only applies to styrene, it applies to any hazardous material. So apparently they're not going to store material, at least for INEOS, at any time in the future. But, you know, if you drive along the rail tracks, which I did several times during the course of this, when I was looking into this story, you see tankers along those rail lines all the time. And the lines that run through Western Hamilton County along River Road, you know, there's a lot of industry there. And so I saw near Sailor Park a lot of tanks holding molten sulfur.
Just stopped? I mean, it wasn't that they were moving on the tracks, they were stopped?
They were stopped on the tracks, yeah. And dozens of cars, you know, during the week that I was looking for them. And it's not clear. I mean, you can't tell from looking at them whether there's actually cargo in there. They could have been tanks that were emptied and they're sitting and waiting for, you know, either CSX or the Central Railroad of Indiana to pick them up. But if you live there, you can't help but notice it, especially now after one of these accidents. So I thought it was a timely time, you know, to do the story because that's on everybody's mind as they drive past that site. If they see tanker cars like the one that, you know, vaporized.
Sure.
You know, they're going to question whether they're safe.
Yeah. So are railroads required to notify communities when they're transporting hazardous materials through their towns?
They are not. The railroad's answer to that question was these cars have, they have these placards on the side which have numbers. Red placards mean they're flammable. And then, you know, you can go to a website, a federal website, name escapes me, but you can go there and find out what's in those cars based on the number that's on this UN placard. And so what their answer was, anytime there's an incident, first responders show up, they're able to tell from the placard what's in that chemical, and they can respond accordingly. And so that is the railroad industry's way of notifying people of what's in the cargo. This railroad inspector also told me that, you know, in the past, this has been an issue for a long time. People don't like hazardous materials near their home for some reason.
Yeah.
Not really sure why. His answer was twofold. A, the railroad takes care of it pretty well. They do keep this stuff moving, and they don't tend to let cargo sit. And they also said that you know, in the past, he's had communities say, well, I want to be notified every time you have cargo in your town. And back in the day when you had fax machines, they would call back a month later and say, hey, our fax machine is clogged. Stop sending that. Because there's so much cargo
sure.
that makes its way through, you know, American cities.
Yeah. Well, in a train, you know, you have so many different tanker cars. I imagine each car could hold something very different. So it's notifying about car after car after car.
Right.
You mentioned this 48-hour rule and that, you know, what the railroad said about that, why it didn't violate that rule because of these exceptions. What did the inspector you talked to, what did he say about that? Did that...
He said the railroad did its job, basically. Yeah, he didn't have a problem with that. The main, he said if he was handling this case, what he would do is approach INEOS and find out why it didn't accept that. He didn't think it was a good idea for this material to be stored, especially across the street from a grocery store. And he didn't like that, and he said he would have pressed INEOS for an answer on why it didn't accept the material. And he also thought that the Federal Railroad Administration, and he would do this as well, force INEOS to explain its process for why it does or doesn't accept and review its transportation policies to make sure that it's not causing this problem, not causing cargo to sit on tracks.
And why being so close to the grocery store, why did he think that was such a concern?
Well, that's where the risk was highest from, you know, this is a chemical that dissipates quickly, according to him, and the emergency management agency. One reason they drew an evacuation line that was only a half mile away is because styrene, once it's released as a liquid, and it looks like a gas when it comes out of the car, it dissipates very quickly. And so it's unlikely that you're going to be harmed the further the way away you are from it. And the Kroger store was basically the biggest location where there's a crowd next to this train track. He also thought that the school was probably far enough away that even in the event of a blast, it wouldn't have caused a great calamity.
Mm. What do you know about what federal officials are investigating now about all this?
What they've said is that they're focusing on the shipper and the receiver. And this inspector I talked to told me that that probably means they're focusing on INEOS, because this chemical came from an INEOS plant in Texas and arrived at an INEOS plant in Cincinnati, ultimately. And so they're both the shipper and the receiver. They're not the rail carrier.
Mm. And have you been able to talk with anybody from INEOS about any of this?
No, I tried several times to reach them. Really, I think the only thing they've said publicly about this is in a footnote to a federal lawsuit filing. There are five pending lawsuits. They've all been consolidated as one case. And in a filing, INEOS basically denied liability.
Hmm. You mentioned those lawsuits. What are, and you know, I know talking about five lawsuits is a lot, but generally, what are they seeking, and where do they stand?
Generally, they're seeking damages for like lost wages or lost productivity, or sometimes businesses. Well, there were businesses that had to close. The grocery store was closed for a while, so those kind of damages. But they're also seeking things like long-term medical monitoring and you know, some healthcare associated with determining that they're not damaged by this leak. And so, in a filing that I read, there's an estimate that this could be a case that leads to more than $5 million in damages, with thousands of people, you know, having a claim.
Hmm. And the only response that you've seen from INEOS is saying, what?
They basically say that we don't admit any liability, any cause of action. We don't admit that we did anything wrong. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what they're saying.
Well, I know that Central Railroad of Indiana has phone numbers for people and businesses affected by the leak. We will have those. You had them in your story, and we will have those on our website, wvxu.org. I've been talking with WCPO9 iTeam reporter Dan Monk. Thanks so much for your time today, Dan.
Thanks, Lucy.
Up next, what's happened to the iconic Big Boy? And what about the employees? The closures next on Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Frisch's Big Boy restaurants have been a favorite gathering place for many local families for generations. But restaurants have been closing in recent months, and more closures could be on the way. We're going to talk about what's happening with Frisch's. And then we'll hear about a Winter Wonderland installation that has some city council members wondering whether city funds should be used for it. Joining me now are local 12 news anchor and reporter Mariella Porter. I'm so sorry.
No, it's fine.
Mariella Porter, welcome to the program, Mariella.
Thank you so much for having me, Lucy.
Tried to give you an extra syllable there. I apologize.
That's okay. It happens all the time.
And WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello. Welcome back, Becca.
Thanks, Lucy.
Marla, let's start with you. For many people in Greater Cincinnati, Frisch's is practically family, but the chain's future appears uncertain. What's going on?
Yeah, I mean, obviously a lot of people have grown up eating Frisch's, going there. Even myself as a non-native Ohioan, I know about Big Boy just from having family members up north. So it's a big deal. So what we learned is pretty much that a bunch of their locations across the Greater Cincinnati area are being evicted.
Yeah. This follows the closure of several other Frisch's locations earlier this year, too, right? What's the background there?
Yeah. So as far as what I know, we reported earlier in April that there were up to at least four locations that had closed abruptly. People who had worked there had no idea, you know, beforehand that this was going to happen. And then it did. And a lot of people, every time we post a story about, you know, Frisch's locations being closed or up in the air of what's going to happen to them, it's a big deal. It gets a lot of traction for people. So, you know, this week we got the news that, hey, there might be something more to look at here. So we were digging through court documents in different places across the tri-state area, Greater Cincinnati. And then that's when we started to find out that, hey, it's more than just they're closing, they're being evicted.
Well, tell us about that. How many Frisch's locations could be in trouble based on all this work that you did?
Based off of one document out of Claremont County, it looked like there were up to 20 Frisch's locations across Southwest Ohio that could be impacted. And this was from the lawyers representing the chain, who wrote that, you know, they needed more time to figure out, you know, how to go about closing their stores. And in that court document, it said that there were up to 20 that were facing these issues. Now, we at Local 12 have counted, I believe, up to 17. The day that I reported it, we counted 9. But then the following day, there were more that came to light. So it's possible that there are up to 20 that could be impacted and maybe more. Who knows?
Yeah. You talked with an employee at a Middletown Frisch's location. Ashley Ferguson told you it breaks her heart.
Yeah.
We wasn't getting the normal food that we got, you know, like our normal shipments. And we found out they wasn't paying the bills. We haven't got butter in probably a month. And the managers have been taking that money out of their own pocket to buy butter for the store. And that's just one of the products.
Yeah, and if you've been to Frisch's, you know they use butter.
Yeah. Yeah, for me, that was shocking to hear that, you know, the managers were, obviously they care about the store. So, you know, that just shows how much they care about their customers and making sure that things run smoothly, that they're taking money out of their own pocket to do this. So for her, Ashley said, you know, it literally started when she noticed that the hash brown shipments weren't regular. So that's when she realized something was off. And yeah, it's just for her, this is a Frisch's that it's the only one she told me that she's ever been to in her whole life.
Oh, wow. She also told you that employees had been kind of reassured that everything was okay. But then what happened?
Yeah, exactly. So she said that they had seen another Frisch's in their area close. So since that was so close to them, you know, they had gone to their managers because obviously these are people who have to feed their children, take care of their families. So they want to make sure that they have a job that they're going to be able to go to the next day or in the coming weeks, months, whatever. They can prepare for anything that happens. So she told me that she had gone to managers and, you know, the corporate side, and they were like, there's nothing to worry about. Everything's fine, but everything ended up not being fine for her when she says that in their employee group chat, someone had taken a photo of the bailiff serving the papers this week that they were being evicted. So, you know, between, you know, having those questions and those doubts from the other location closing and then, you know, a couple of months later, having the bailiff serve the papers, I don't think there was much communication, but they were, I guess, assured that everything would be okay. And clearly that just wasn't the case.
Oh, how disappointing. You mentioned this lawsuit filed in Claremont County. This company, NNN Wright Incorporated, is Frisch's landlord, as I understand it. That company's website says it owns like 66 Frisch's properties. And you said the lawsuit says that upwards of 20 are facing eviction?
Yeah. So basically in the lawsuit, it's the company, Frisch's, the company that owns Frisch's, wanting more time to figure out what to do because they did cite that, you know, it was causing, you know, costing them money. And then also, you know, they wanted a chance to give their employees time to figure out what to do so they can notify their employees beforehand. They mentioned, you know, abrupt job losses from these evictions and them having to be in court every week for the next few weeks through November because of how many evictions they were facing. So I know this week or in the next week, at least two are definitely going to close and are being evicted. The others are more so still in the, you know, court process of that.
Sure, that whole process. Well, and you, your original story identified, I think it was 7 or 8 other potential closures. I don't know if you remember off the top of your head kind of what parts of town those are in. If not, we will tell people to check out Local 12's website.
Absolutely. They were all over. There was Franklin, there was Lebanon, there was Green Township, Anderson, Batavia.
Wow.
So all over.
Yeah.
It wasn't just like one part, one region of the area. It's like just random.
Yeah. Well, and of course, this is upsetting for customers, but it has to be worse for employees. We're going to hear again from Ashley Ferguson.
It's not fair that you're just going to leave all these people without a job. Their kids need fed, clothed. It's just, it's not right.
Mm. What have you heard from Ashley about what she's got to do? I mean, I guess she figures she's just got to find another job.
Yeah. So she said that she was only working part time at Frisch's. So she actually told me, you know, she was thankful that she had work with Amazon on the side. So she's going to fall back on that. And she said she was going to get right into the job search. But she did have concerns for her coworkers who maybe aren't as fortunate and do have, you know, kids to feed and their families to take care of. She said, you know, she works with a lot of older people who literally have worked there for decades. And she didn't know how they were going to, you know, be after they shut down because maybe they don't have, you know, the transferable skills. They're older. We know how that goes. So she had concerns for them. But for Ashley herself, she said she was going to fall back on Amazon. And, you know, obviously she was thinking about her coworkers and even the customers that come through every day. And, you know, they're used to seeing and serving.
Yeah. Did you get a sense while doing this story or even after hearing feedback that you've been getting from this story, what Frisch's means to the community, what it means to customers?
Yeah. I mean, it's part of their lives. One of our reporters, Paige Barnes, that same day that I did my report, she went out to the location that was closing, I believe, either Loveland or Lebanon. I can't remember which one, but one of them is closing this week. And she went there and she spoke to a couple that was literally just in the drive-thru to get dinner. And on the sign that they have out front, it said, "We will miss you." It was so sad. And this couple said they had their first date there and they had been married for 50 years. So that's, I mean, it just shows how big of a deal this is for people and how big of a part of their lives it is.
Yeah, what it really means to people. Any sense for the time frame with all this, like how quickly these other locations might close? Did you get any sense of that from the court filing or any of the other reporting you've done?
Many of them are scheduled to appear in court like literally every week through November. So it could be very abrupt and quick when this all happens. I'm sure it could happen before the end of the year, within the next couple of weeks. I think it just depends and we'll just have to at least on our end, see how it plays out with, you know, the company that owns Frisch's, their landlord, and whether the courts will give them more time to sort all of this out.
Yeah, this could require a lot of people to change their pumpkin pie plans for Thanksgiving if that happens. Well, Becca, I want to turn to you. There's a new winter display coming to Washington Park. It came up in council this week because of this issue of funding. This installation had some council members divided. Tell us about it. What is this thing?
So this has been described as a winter wonderland to transform Washington Park. And another way to put it is the ballet really had the idea to move, like bring some of the Nutcracker outside of music hall. So obviously it's kind of a beloved yearly tradition that folks might go see the Nutcracker. They wanted to make that more accessible, bring it out into the park, into the public for folks to kind of interact with. So what you can expect to see are some new lighting installations, some holiday lighting. And then in addition to that, they've partnered with the Art Academy of Cincinnati, and students from there are going to be recreating some of the sets from the Nutcracker Ballet. So there will be six sort of story locations. You can go along the path to visit each of the story locations, each one having a different part of the set, and take pictures. You know, there's going to be a QR code. You can see a video to learn some of the dances for each of the particular areas. So yeah, that's pretty much it.
Ah, and the city of Cincinnati is helping pay for this, right? How much is the city spending on this?
That's right. City Council approved $75,000 this week. That is the full cost of the project. Now, the sets will be recreated. So you may be familiar, the Art Academy does kind of like a summer program where they do sculptures in Washington Park with duct tape. It'll be the same as that. So they'll be using duct tape to create all of the sets, which, but obviously not just the gray duct tape. They're very colorful sets if you've ever seen the Nutcracker. So other than some donated tape that has been donated for that purpose, $75,000 will cover all of it. And this is coming from a contingency, basically a reserve account for the general fund.
Okay, so is this like leftover money that they weren't expecting to have?
Just kind of. It's next year's leftover money. So it's not leftover yet. However, so this is
anticipated leftovers.
Exactly.
Like
so,
Thanksgiving.
There you go. Oh, nice. Full circle there,
there we
Lucy.
Go. Thank you.
So basically, the council has approved most of the carryover budget, and included in that is this waterfall. So whatever was left over from last fiscal year, it goes into several savings accounts. There is a long-established, much, much bigger actual general fund savings account that we're not talking about. That's been established for a long time. A couple of years ago, they established a sort of additional general fund savings account. Basically, so council could spend it on some operating things. So last year they spent, out of $500,000, they spent all but like $28,000 of it. So it's not unusual for council to be spending this money at this point in the year. You know, if you can say anything is usual, if it's only been around for a couple of years. But that was a lot of convoluted nonsense that probably didn't make sense to anyone. I apologize.
No, it made sense
to me. It's very wonky.
You're doing great, Becca.
Thank you.
Don't you say that about yourself. This wasn't a unanimous vote. What were the arguments for and against allocating this $75,000 for this winter wonderland?
Well, the arguments against are really, you know, should council be spending reserve money? So what this is contingency for, you know, if things, unexpected expenses come up, you know, on the surface, that's kind of the purpose of this account. And so Councilmember Mark Jeffries was, you know, one of the ones who voted against it. And he said, this is like, you know, spending emergency money on something that's not an emergency. Now, other council members, and I should clarify, Mark Jeffries and the other two council members who voted against it as well, they all said, we love this idea. We're in support of the city, supporting it financially. They just would have preferred to see the source from somewhere else. So they weren't opposed to the city spending any money on this project, but they did not approve of the source of that.
Hmm. Does the city have lots of other sources it could have tapped into to find this money?
Maybe. That's a good question. You know, it's the kind of thing. So there was a question that Councilmember Scotty Johnson brought up. The city has kind of recently changed the way it funds big events. So things like Blink, the River Roots Festival that's coming up soon, the Forbes 30 Under 30 was another one they gave funding to. And kind of change that in a way to say, you know, we need these folks to come before council and kind of give a presentation about how they're going to spend that money. That has, you know, come from just the general fund. but this doesn't really qualify as that. And it's new enough that, you know, the city has kind of already spent the money that they had allocated for big events already. So it wasn't eligible for that. But that was a question that Councilmember Johnson had. You asked also about what the arguments in favor of spending this money, and Councilmember Seth Walsh was the one who proposed it. One of his arguments was, we're not going to come back and ask for this money again next year. That, you know, some of this money is going towards things that we'll be able to carry over into future years, future, you know, installations at Washington Park. And so this is a one-time thing. It's not going to be a regular part of the budget.
So what this that stuff that will carry over is that equipment. I mean, I can't imagine they're going to be able to save the duct tape stuff for years.
Maybe,
but I don't know.
I don't know.
It's pretty waterproof, like maybe. But do you know what he's talking about that they can reuse?
Well, and again, the duct tape piece of it was donated, so
oh,
I imagine
right, okay.
that there's you know some possibility of that being
$75,000 would buy a lot of duct tape.
But I imagine it'll take a lot of duct tape to do this as well. What most of it will be able to carry over is the lighting installation. So the actual part with the nutcracker scenes and that kind of thing, that'll be through the whole month of December. But the additional lighting that they're putting in, that's going to stay in Washington Park at least through February 2025. So kind of through the rest of the you know early holidays there. So mostly that. However, some of this money is just going towards paying the ballet performers. You know, they are part of a union. So there's going to be kind of a big kickoff event on December 2nd where you can get meet and greet and photos with some of the dancers, also photos of Santa Claus. So some of it covers the cost of that event. But again, Councilmember Walsh has said that he's not planning to come back and ask for more money next year.
Okay.
So let's hold him to that.
Well, you mentioned this is coming from, I'm going to paraphrase, anticipated leftover money. Council does still have millions of dollars left over from the last budget. Any word on when they're going to be deciding how to spend that?
Yeah, it seems likely City Council's Budget and Finance Committee will vote on that on Monday. However, so there are several motions on the agenda for different ideas for how to spend the money. There's about $15 million left. It's unclear if they'll reach a consensus enough on Monday in order to take a final vote on Wednesday, but it seems that the intention is to make those final decisions next week.
Okay. Well, we've talked about Thanksgiving and pumpkin pie with Frishes. We're talking about the winter holidays and this winter wonderland. Let me tell you, we're going to have some special Halloween coverage on Thursday on Cincinnati Edition. We're going to have some nationally known storytellers to freak us out with spooky stories. I know you're looking forward to that, Becca.
My
you seem
favorite.
Very excited. Yeah. Do you like scary stories?
I love scary
Do
stories.
Do you tune in? Tune in at noon on Halloween. We're also going to talk about why we're so addicted to Halloween candy. I'm going to go rogue here. Marella, what's your favorite Halloween candy? Do you like Halloween candy? Maybe you're disciplined and you don't eat Halloween candy. I don't know. Maybe you're an apple person. I'm not judging. But
no.
Do you have a favorite Halloween candy?
I mean, I love Twix. So if I find a Twix in my Halloween, you know,
good. That's
my
a good
pumpkin.
Choice.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Good thinking. Twix, Becca?
Candy what? Corn all the way.
Wow.
Candy
okay.
corn. I
okay.
am a pro candy corn person.
I
most
I,
controversial thing I've ever said
is.
On this show.
It is. It is.
Do you like candy corn?
No.
I'm glad we have both sides of the candy corn
That's
debate
right.
represented.
We're balanced here at WBXU.
Balanced coverage. Didn't even plan it. It just happened. That is that's journalism, people. We're here for it. Well, I've been talking with Local 12 news anchor and reporter Marella Porter and WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thanks, Lucy.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director today is Ella Rowan. If you miss our program live, you can subscribe to Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening. Hope you have a great weekend.